The difference in places that experience criminal governance isn't so much in the level of service that you get, it's who you get it from. You may really depend on a local gang to keep you safe. The problem is that that gang is actually considered criminal by the state.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. If weak states fail to provide order and security to their citizens, well, sometimes others step in, and that undermines the state even more. Can this problem be fixed by targeting resources to the places most in need of help? And what happens when we do? Ben Lessing of the University of Chicago was part of a project to do this in one of Colombia's largest cities, and he joins me now in a London park, quite the opposite of some of the places we're going to be talking about, to tell me what happened and why. Ben, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Hello, Tim. Thanks.
Ben, as I said, we're sitting in a very peaceful park in central London, and London, generally speaking, is a city in which the institutions of the state mostly deliver security and mostly provide order. So as a resident of London, how does this affect my day-to-day life?
Security is a big issue for everyone everywhere in every city in the world. And I think we'd be naive to think that here in London, there aren't issues of crime.
Just
the other day, you know, I was having lunch and the guy had had a break-in the night before, even in nice districts of a major world capital like this. I think the biggest way that it affects the life of residents is who do you turn to when there is an issue? Residents in a city like London, in a neighborhood like Kensington, they're going to probably go to the police and they'll probably get some kind of response.
Yeah.
Or maybe they'll turn to a neighborhood watch or even a private security firm. But those are all groups that are going to be sanctioned by the state in one way or another, licensed, allowed to provide the kind of services that they do. The difference in places that experience criminal governance isn't so much in the level of service that you get, it's who you get it from. So you may really depend on a local gang to keep you safe. If somebody steals your bike, you may turn to a local gang to find the perpetrator and get your bike back. And they might be quite effective at it. The problem is that that gang is actually considered criminal by the state. They're not licensed by the state. On the contrary, in theory, the state's trying to arrest those gang members or stop that gang from existing. And the kind of governance or order that that gang provides in the neighborhood, it might be functional, but it's not really legal or licit. And so you as a resident are put in a bit of a bind. You're really kind of serving two masters or dealing with two different authority, sources of authority that are actually at odds with one another.
And we're talking about Medellin today in Colombia. Who is this alternative provider of criminal governance there?
Medellin is second largest city in Colombia. It's a it's a pretty wealthy city in many ways. It's kind of the manufacturing core economic, one of the big economic producers of Colombia. And it's set on a valley. And so most of the formal part of the city is in the bottom of the valley along the river with some of the wealthier neighborhoods along one part. And a lot of the poorer neighborhoods are up along the hills. Not exclusively, but that's a general picture. And in those poorer neighborhoods, there are neighborhood gangs that have been around for a long time. They're called combos, or sometimes they just call them the boys, muchachos. And almost every one of Medellin's 300-400 neighborhoods has one of these local gangs. Now, these gangs are bound together in larger federations, the quite complex sort of ecosystem of organized crime families and high-level firms. But at the neighborhood level, everyone knows who their local gang is. And that local gang is generally going to be responsible for basic things, making sure nobody steals in the neighborhood, settling neighborhood disputes, as well as increasingly engaging in a wide range of other economic activities. Some more licit and some more illicit than others. Everything from drug retailing to oftentimes selling food staples or providing private protection in terms of car parks or other kind of private security, almost like a small business that they'll run on the side.
You've researched a lot of cities in the world. Is Medellin unusual in this respect?
Absolutely not. Criminal governance is a phenomenon that I think you can observe in just about any city in Latin America that I've been to. If you go out to the urban periphery, to these sort of often informal neighborhoods, lower income neighborhoods, neighborhoods that are not integrated into the formal city, there's almost always some form of criminal governance. Now, how intense that governance is and what it looks like on the ground varies immensely. The city that I study the most probably is Rio de Janeiro, and that's a place where the local gangs have real military grade weapons, and the police can only come in when they engage in a sort of organized military operation, that's a place where criminal governance is very intense, and it's and almost to the exclusion of the state. Not entirely, but almost. Then you have places where the local gang is quite weak and maybe doesn't have that much power over residents, only in a few areas or over a few issues. I think Medellin is a middle case where the gangs have a long history in the neighborhood. They are sort of the primary provider of public security on a day-to-day basis. They're an important dispute resolution service provider, but you know, they're not walking around with machine guns patrolling the perimetry.
Are we saying then these are basically equivalent services to having security provided by the government? What's the disadvantage of what we're calling criminal governance?
That's the million-dollar question. It's obvious that for first best world, we have an efficient, efficacious state that comes in and provides security and all kinds of dispute resolution services and public health and public education to everyone on an equal basis. Sure, that would be great. Everybody agrees that's the best outcome. But in a world where the state doesn't deliver a lot of these services, these gangs can be quite efficacious. They have a lot of local knowledge. They know everyone in the community. They've been there a long time. They've often established trustworthiness relationships with community members and even elders. They have a sense of community norms. And so there's times when they can be as or more effective than the government in responding to certain issues that come up. Now, that may not look pretty. You know, one of the key things that these gangs do is police things like sex crimes, pedophilia. And one of the reasons that they do is because residents can turn to them when something terrible happens, and these gangs will go out and find the perpetrator and often kill them or lynch them.
Right. Yeah.
And so that kind of rough justice is something the state is never going to provide. We don't want the state to provide, but there's real demand for it in these kinds of communities. So it's a very complex picture, and it's important to emphasize that for residents, these two sources of governance overlap, and they can be complementary. Residents can turn to both the state and the gangs at different times. And so in some ways, this is an important source of governance services for low-income, marginalized communities. That said, they're also put in that double bind where the gang can be telling them, hey, don't talk to the cops. If we catch you talking to anyone from the state, you're in trouble. So I don't want to paint too rosy of a picture. But part of what makes criminal governance such a difficult issue is that it really is providing something of use to these communities and in the end to the state itself by governing in these communities where the state does have a low presence and a low ability to be effective.
For the state to improve its ability to be effective, it's described to me recently by an economist as wanting to turn every country into Denmark. It's expensive. It's really hard to do. So for the government in Medellin to become more effective at providing these services in these neighborhoods, which is what we're talking about today, that costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of effort. What's the benefit to the government from doing that in this sort of cost-benefit analysis?
We worked with the city government of Medellin on this experiment to see if they might be able to increase state presence in some of these gang-controlled neighborhoods. Mm. There's the costs and benefits from the point of view of the mayor or the elected official, right? And they're often looking for something that they can turn around and show to voters in the short run. But there's a larger sort of cost-benefit analysis in terms of social benefits in the long run, and those two can often be at odds. And then finally, there's just a kind of hard budget question. How much are we actually spending? Mm. The experiment that we did with the city government, it wasn't terribly expensive in money terms. In many ways, it looked like a very good investment on paper. We sent these what were called liaisons. These were city government employees. They weren't police officers. They were college-educated, mostly psychology graduates who went into these communities to serve as a bridge between the community and the already existing state services, which so often don't reach these low-income communities. These liaisons were intensively focused on a very small sector, not even an entire neighborhood, a very small, delimited sector, so that they were able to give very personalized attention. But, you know, so that was a cost to the government, but it wasn't some crazy costly infrastructure project or anything like that. Had it worked more, had it proven wildly effective, I think we would have hit upon a very cost-effective kind of intervention for the state. I would say it wasn't a cheapskate intervention. It looked very good on paper, let's put it that way.
In how many of these areas did you do this intervention?
So we selected 80 sectors. Again, these sectors were quite small, sometimes three or four city blocks. And these 80 sectors were chosen to, they were all relatively high levels of gang governance at the outset of the experiment, but there was still some variation on that and some other important variables. And then we took half of them and we gave them this intensive treatment of these liaisons. So we sent 40 liaisons into 40 of these sectors, and the other sectors were control. They just got whatever they had been getting all along, which allowed us to run a field experiment and try to gauge the causal impact of having this intensive treatment of state presence. There was an additional intervention in some of these 40 sectors where the city government would set up what they called a caravana or a caravan, and city employees would be there and meet with residents and tell them about what they did in the city government, as again, as a way of reaching out and letting people know about the kind of services that were available.
What sort of things did they hope to improve? How did they go about doing this day to day?
So on a day-to-day basis, these liaisons were there at community meetings. They were contact points. They would provide information. And this is where things get kind of interesting. We worried that the local gangs might interfere with the liaisons. We interviewed all the liaisons afterwards, and we very carefully coded all their responses. And very few reported any kind of problem with the local gang. The local gangs were accepting. Then we worried about the converse problem. We worried that the gangs were going to take credit for anything that the liaisons did. But that also didn't seem to happen too much. It wasn't highly reported. Let me just kind of cut to the chase. The result of this experiment was very little impact. And after about a year and a half of treatment, we saw very little statistically significant difference between the treatment and control groups on a series of important variables. Now, the outcomes we were measuring were a measurement of what we call state and gang governance, which is how much people turn to either the state or to the gang to resolve their problems. Importantly, we let those vary independently of each other. So you could turn to both the state and the gang more or less. It was very important not to treat that as a zero-sum game. And then we also measured gang and state legitimacy. Do you think they do a good job? Do you think they're fair? Would the community be better off without them? Those sorts of questions. On these two different indices that we generated for each of state and gang, the overall average, what we call the average treatment effect of receiving these liaisons, was very low and not terribly statistically significant. So it just didn't seem like it had a big impact.
But you're calling that the average treatment effect.
That's
right. If we break that down a little bit more, are there areas where it is more successful than others?
Yes, and that's some of the more interesting results from this project. When we separate our sample into the places where gang governance was very high at the outset versus the places where it was a little bit lower at the outset. Now, globally, these were all places with strong gangs, but when we compare them to each other, some were stronger than others. If we look at those places where the state was stronger at the outset, we do get a significant impact on state governance and a positive impact. So in other words, if we look at the places where the state was already somewhat present, the intervention had a positive impact there, increasing people's use of state resources and their perception of the legitimacy of the state. If we look at places where the gang was stronger at the outset, we see no positive impact on people's impressions of the state, and in some cases, a negative impact, as though even trying to do anything in those neighborhoods seemed to make the problem worse.
This is counterintuitive, isn't it, Ben? I would expect it to be the opposite.
You know, the naive view going into these things is, well, the place where there's barely any state services, they're going to be thirsty for anything. And
Absolutely.
Even just a drop in the bucket will...
That's what you think, isn't it?
Yeah, that's in some ways, that's sort of the conventional wisdom, right? But our sense of things, and again, you know, this was just one experiment. We can't back all of this up scientifically, but our sense of things, our conjecture coming out of this experience, is that what we may be looking at is not a straight line curve where you start with zero, you get the biggest effects, and then it drops down over time, but rather a world where when the state presence is very low, early initial investments can have a very little payoff and even a negative payoff. The reason for the negative payoff, as far as we can tell, is that the state comes in, these liaisons show up, they're telling everybody about these state services that they have access to, but then when it comes down to brass tacks, the state can't actually deliver. People go to the caravan and the person from the office gives them their phone number, and then when they actually have a problem, they call the phone number and nobody answers.
Right, yeah.
And so now you've raised people's expectations and they've been disappointed by the state. Meanwhile, the gang is always still right there. You call the gang and they show up right away. So these kind of interventions we call sometimes the failed promise of the state. These can actually have, it seems to us, a negative impact on people's impressions of the state, of their sense of the state's legitimacy. So there's a very dangerous zone there where people are not yet even sold on the idea of the state at all as a provider. If you go in and make a bunch of promises, you risk even sort of cementing that impression in their minds. Now, you go into a place where the state does already have a foothold and you make things easier for people and they actually gain access and they actually experience state services, then you might be able to start reinforce and build up a sense of state legitimacy and possibly chip away at people's reliance on gangs for these governance services.
It's part of the problem that we're expecting results to happen in months rather than decades. And these institutional problems, well, they're very slow to change because the problems are so deep-rooted.
Well, there's no doubt about the issue of time frame and the slow-moving nature of sort of state building and extending the state's capacity versus the needs of an electoral cycle, the needs of a governor who or a mayor who's in office for 4 years and needs to show some quick results. Those are very serious issues. That said, this intervention did go on for over a year, so, you know, it wasn't just a flash in the pan. My own view on this is that while, of course, it does take time, it's going to take a long time, and if we really want to eliminate criminal governance, it's going to be on a long-term basis, what we sometimes call salami tactics, where you sort of slice a little bit off at a time. You don't try to eliminate the gang in one fell swoop, but slowly hem them in and have them controlling fewer and fewer activities in daily life, and the state sort of taking over responsibility little by little. I think that's in fact the way that states like, for example, here in England or in the United States, I think that's how criminal governance was slowly clawed away from gangs in our cities in the 19th century and early 20th century. That said, I'm not totally sure that time alone will fix this. I think part of the issue is that cities like Medellin experience a kind of bifurcation, a kind of splitting, where parts of the city do get a lot of state investment, do get a lot of public investment, and they have high income levels, real estate markets are booming, construction is booming, and you get these neighborhoods that they compare favorably with European neighborhoods in terms of crime rates, in terms of other economic indicators, while other neighborhoods continue to be governed by criminal organizations. And though they don't have good indices and they do have poverty and other social problems, it's not chaotic. It's not pandemonium in these neighborhoods. They are well governed. They function. And so they serve the larger purpose of economic development and urbanization that drive these sort of middle income countries. And so there's no sort of immediate problem that the state needs to address. These gangs have been governing in Medellin for 20 or 30 years. Same thing for Rio, same thing for urban peripheries throughout Latin America. While these countries have experienced industrialization, urbanization, and sort of large-scale macro changes, it's not clear to me that this is a problem that's going to necessarily get addressed by itself, that it only requires time. I think it also does require a real dedication to the idea of bringing all citizens in to a formal economy, to a formal urbanity. And that's not something that's necessarily going to be an electoral winner.
It is not something that is very appetizing to a lot of politicians, I would guess, because they look for results, visible results. Where we're sitting now, this borough is extremely rich. There are also some islands of poverty inside this borough, and the residents complain that when there are resources to be allocated, then the local government allocates them to the wealthier areas because they're more visible, they achieve more visible gains for them. Is there something strategic in this that these areas sometimes get left behind because they are so hard to help?
Well, yeah, that's one of our sort of conjectural findings. If you take our findings literally, it suggests that from, say, a city mayor's perspective, if I invest in these places that have very low state presence, these very worst off areas, not only may I not see a short-term gain, I may actually see a negative return. Things might actually get worse in that neighborhood, or residents may actually think less of the local government. You know, that's a no-brainer. Why am I going to direct those scant resources towards a place where the return on my investment is low or even negative? Meanwhile, these places where the state already does have a presence, I've already got local offices. If I just put a few more resources over there, I'm going to see a big return because those resources are going to be implemented by professional staff. People already know that the state does things. They'll see that the budget has increased. They'll be happy with with the new gardens or the new fountain or the new extended hours of service or whatever, they'll be able to cleanly identify that as a project of my government. There's a very perilous divergence in the kind of return on investment that officials may perceive when deciding whether to invest in the very hardest hit and least well-served areas of a city and the better-served areas of a city that can contribute to this dynamic where the resources always seem to flow to the better-off areas. I would say that that is particularly problematic in countries with very high income inequality, and that is endemic to Latin America. So yes. I don't think it's a mistake that we see these kind of bifurcating realities in places with high income inequality.
Very important problems to solve in the future because more and more people are moving to these cities and more people are moving to the areas of the cities where there are low levels of service and this type of criminal governance.
Yeah, if I can pull on that thread for just a second. People have been studying criminal governance for decades now, but it's almost always on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
A single city, often just a single neighborhood. A lot of what we know is from ethnographers and anthropologists who spend a lot of time in a particular slum and they observe criminal governance firsthand. It's often very hard to observe from a distance. One project I've been involved in is trying to just gauge the extent of criminal governance in Latin America at a regional scale, and that's quite hard to do. We spent several years trying to estimate it just gathering together these ethnographic reports and journalistic reports. But recently in 2020, the survey firm Latin Barometer, which does nationally representative survey applied all over Latin America, finally included a couple questions that speak to the issue of criminal governance. They asked people, do you have a gang in your neighborhood? And the people who said yes, they asked them, well, here are some things. What of these things does the gang do? And those options included things like reduce crime in the neighborhood or put order in the neighborhood. And so that allowed us to get at least a very rough measure of how common criminal governance is at the macro regional hemispheric scale. And quite to our surprise, the number was much higher than we had estimated using our earlier method. Now, of course, it's a survey. It's got all kinds of problems. But if you just take the numbers and the responses and you assume that they're nationally representative as they're supposed to be, you come out to 79 million people in Latin America living under some form of criminal governance, which is really, I think, quite an astonishing number. You know, almost 80 million people living under something that is really quite far from the notion of a monopoly on the use of force. It's really something much more like what we call a duopoly of violence, where you've got both the state and this gang in a very tense, but really ultimately stable equilibrium. And really, I think a lot of residents caught in the middle.
Yeah, those realities that we don't see reported quite as much as they should be. Ben, thank you very much for talking about it today.
My pleasure, Tim. Thanks for having me.
If you want to read the paper, it's called State Building on the Margin, an Urban Experiment in Medellin. The authors are Chris Blattman, Gustavo Duncan, Ben Lessing, and Santiago Tobon. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, and the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. But you will also find all of the Vox Dev Talks at voxdev.org, where you'll also find articles about the papers we feature.